7. The Southing. Bright above the roof peaks burned the star whose rising told the start of winter, as cheerlessly bright as Wald remembered it from his boyhood 60 moon phases ago. Even the great slender crescent moon opposite it in the sky seemed paler than the snow star. A new moon phase had begun, and a new season, but not auspiciously. Was it true what the Farborns used to say, that the moon was a world like Ascatavar and the other ranges, though without living creatures? And the stars, too, were worlds where men and beasts lived and summer and winter came? What sort of men would dwell on the snow star? Terrible beings, white as snow, with pallid, lipless mouths and fiery eyes, stalked through Wold's imagination. He shook his head and tried to pay attention to what the other elders were saying. The forerunners had returned after only 5 days with various rumors from the north, and the elders had built a fire in the great court of Tavar and held a stone pounding. Wold had come last and closed the circle, for no other man dared. But it was meaningless, humiliating to him. For the war he had declared was not being fought, the men he had sent had not gone, and the alliance he had made was broken. Beside him, as silent as he, sat Umaksiman. The others shouted and wrangled, getting nowhere. What did they expect? No rhythm had risen out of the pounding of stones. There had been only clatter and conflict. After that, could they expect to agree on anything? Fools, fools, Wold thought, glowering at the fire that was too far away to warm him. The others were mostly younger. They could keep warm with youth and with shouting at one another. But he was an old man, and furs did not warm him out under the glaring snow star in the wind of winter. His legs ached now with cold, his chest hurt, and he did not know or care what they were all quarreling about. Umaksiman was suddenly on his feet. "Listen," he said, and the thunder of his voice. "He got that from me," thought Wold. Compelled them, though there were audible mutters and jeers. So far, though everybody had a fair idea what had happened, the immediate cause or pretext of their quarrel with Landon had not been discussed outside the walls of Wold's kinhouse. It had simply been announced that Umaksiman was not to lead the foray, that there was to be no foray, that there might be an attack from the Farborns. Those of other houses who knew nothing about Rollery or Agat knew what was actually involved. A power struggle between factions in the most powerful clan. This was covertly going on in every speech made now in the stone pounding, the subject of which was nominally whether the Farborns were to be treated as enemies when met beyond the walls. Now Umaksiman spoke. "Listen, elders of Tavar. You say this, you say that, but you have nothing left to say. The Gal are coming. Within 3 days they are here. Be silent, and go sharpen your spears, go look to our gates and walls. Because the enemy comes, they come down on us. See?" He flung out his arm to the north, and many turned to stare where he pointed, as if expecting the hordes of the Southing to burst through the wall that moment, so urgent was Umaksiman's rhetoric. "Why didn't you look to the gate your kinswoman went out of, Umaksiman?" Now it was said. "She's your kinswoman too, Uquet," Umaksiman said wrathfully. One of them was Wold's son, the other his grandson. They spoke of his daughter. For the first time in his life, Wold knew shame, bald, helpless shame before all the best men of his people. He sat moveless, his head bowed down.
"Yes, she is. And because of me, no shame rests on our kin.
I and my brothers knocked the teeth out of the dirty face of that one she lay with, and I had him down to geld him as he animal should be gelded. But then you stopped us, Umaksaman. You stopped us with your fool talk. I stopped you so that we wouldn't have the Farborns to fight along with the Gaal, you fool. She's of age to sleep with a man if she chooses, and this is no... He was no man, kinsman. And I am no fool. You are a fool, Ukwet, for you jumped at this as a chance to make quarrel with the Farborns, and so lost us our one chance to turn aside the Gaal. I do not hear you, liar, traitor. They met with a yell in the middle of the circle, axes drawn. Wold got up. Men sitting near him looked up, expecting him as eldest and clan chief to stop the fight. But he did not. He turned away from the broken circle, and in silence, with his stiff, ponderous shuffle, went down the alley between the high slant roofs under projecting eaves to the house of his kin. He clambered laboriously down earthen stairs into the stuffy, smoky warmth of the immense dugout room. Boys and womenfolk came asking him if the stone pounding was over and why he came alone. Umaksaman and Ukwet are fighting, he said to get rid of them, and sat down by the fire, his legs right in the fire pit. No good would come of this. No good would come of anything anymore. When crying women brought in the body of his grandson Ukwet, a thick path of blood dropping behind them from the axe-split skull, he looked on without moving or speaking.
Umaksaman killed him, his kinsman, his brother.
Ukwet's wives shrilled at Wold, who never raised his head. Finally, he looked around at them heavily like an old animal beset by hunters, and said in a thick voice, "Be still. Can't you be still?" It snowed again next day. They buried Ukwet, the first dead of the winter, and the snow fell on the corpse's face before the grave was filled. Wold thought then and later of Umaksaman, outlawed, alone in the hills, in the snow. Which was better off? His tongue was very thick, and he did not like to talk. He stayed by the fire and was not sure sometimes whether outside it was day or night. He did not sleep well. He seemed somehow always to be waking up. He was just waking up when the noise began outside, up above ground. Women came shrieking in from the side rooms, grabbing up their little fall-born brats. "The Gaal! The Gaal!" they screeched. Others were quiet, as befitted women of a great house, and put the place in order and sat down to wait. No man came for Wold. He knew he was no longer a chief. But was he no longer a man? Must he stay with the babies and women by the fire, in a hole in the ground? He had endured public shame, but the loss of his own self-respect he could not endure, and shaking a little he got up and began to rummage in his old painted chest for his leather vest and his heavy spear, the spear with which he had killed a snow ghoul single-handed very long ago. He was stiff and heavy now, and all the bright seasons had passed since then, but he was the same man, the same that had killed with that spear in the snow of another winter. Was he not the same man? They should not have left him here by the fire when the enemy came. His fool womenfolk came squealing around him, and he got mixed up and angry. But old Curly drove them all off, gave him back his spear that one of them had taken from him, and fastened at his neck the cape of gray choreo fur she had made for him in autumn. There was one left who knew what a man was. She watched him in silence, and he felt her grieving pride. So he walked very erect. She was a cross old woman, and he was a foolish old man, but pride remained. He climbed up into the cold, bright noon, hearing beyond the walls the calling of foreign voices. Men were gathered on the square platform over the smoke hole of the House of Absence. They made way for him when he hoisted himself up the ladder. He was wheezing and trembling so that at first he could see nothing. Then he saw. For a while he forgot everything in the unbelievable sight. The valley that wound from north to south along the base of Tavar Hill to the river valley east of the forest was full. Full as the river in the flood time, swarming, overrunning with people. They were moving southward, a sluggish, jumbled, dark flood, stretching and contracting, stopping and starting with yells, cries, calls, creaking, snapping whips, the hoarse bray of Han, the wail of babies, the tuneless chanting of travoy pullers. The flash of color from a rolled-up red felt tent, a woman's painted bangles, a red plume, a spearhead. The stink, the noise, the movement, always the movement, moving southward. The southing. But in all time past, there had never been a southing like this. So many all together. As far as I could follow up the widening valley northward, there were more coming, and behind them more, and behind them more. And these were only the women and the brats and the baggage train. Beside that slow torrent of people, the winter city of Tavar was nothing, a pebble on the edge of a river in flood. At first Wold felt sick. Then he took heart and said presently, "This is a wonderful thing." And it was, this migration of all the nations of the north. He was glad to have seen it. The man next to him, an elder, Anweld of Siokman's kin, shrugged and answered quietly, "But it's the end of us, if they stop here. These won't, but the warriors come behind." They were so strong, so safe in their numbers, that their warriors came behind. "They'll need our stores and our herds tonight to feed all those," Anweld went on. "As soon as these get by, they'll attack. Send our women and children out into the hills to the west, then. This city is only a trap against such a force." "I listen," Anweld said with a shrug of assent. "Now, quickly, before the Gaul encircle us." "This has been said and heard, but others say we can't send our women out to fend for themselves while we stay in the shelter of the walls."
"Then let's go with them," Wold growled. "Can the men of Tavar decide nothing?"
"They have no leader," Anweld said. "They follow this man and that man and no man." To say more would be to seem to blame Wold and his kinsmen. He said no more, except, "So we wait here to be destroyed."
"I'm going to send my women folk off," Wold said, irked by Anwell's cool hopelessness, and he left the mighty spectacle of the southing to lower himself down the ladder and go tell his kinsfolk to save themselves while there was some chance. He meant to go with them, for there was no fighting such odds. And some few of the people of Tavar must survive. But the younger men of his clan did not agree and would not take his orders. They would stand and fight. "But you'll die," said Wold, "and your women and children might go free if they're not here with you."
His tongue was thick again. They could hardly wait for him to finish.
"We'll beat off the Gaul," said a young grandson. "We are warriors."
"Tavar is a strong city, eldest," another said, persuasive, flattering.
"You told us, and taught us to build it well."
"It will stand against winter," Wold said, "not against 10,000 warriors. I would rather see my women die of the cold in the bare hills than live as whores and slaves of the Gaul."
But they were not listening, only waiting for him to be done talking. He went outside again, but was too weary now to climb the ladders to the platform again. He found himself a place to wait out of the way of the coming and going in the narrow alleys, a niche by a supporting buttress of the south wall not far from the gate. If he clambered up on the slanting mud-brick buttress, He could look over the wall and watch the Southing going by. When the wind got under his cape, he could squat down, chin on knees, and have some shelter in the angle. For a while the sun shone on him there. He squatted in its warmth and did not think of much. Once or twice he glanced up at the sun, the winter sun, old, weak in its old age. Winter grasses, the short-lived, hasty-flowering little plants that would thrive between the blizzards until midwinter, when the snow did not melt and nothing lived but the rootless snow crop, already were pushing up through the trampled ground under the wall. Always something lived, each creature biding its time through the great year, flourishing and dying down to wait again. The long hours went by. There was crying and shouting at the northwest corner of the walls. Men went running by through the ways of the little city, alleys wide enough for one man only under the overhanging eaves. Then the roar of shouting was behind Wold's back, and outside the gate to his left, the high wooden slide gate that lifted from inside by means of long pulleys rattled in its frame. They were ramming a log against it. Wold got up with difficulty. He had got so stiff sitting there in the cold that he could not feel his legs. He leaned a minute on his spear, then got a footing with his back against the buttress and held his spear ready, not with the thrower, but poised to use at short range. The Gaul must be using ladders, for they were already inside the city over at the north side, he could tell by the noise. A spear sailed clear over the roofs, overshot with a thrower. The gate rattled again. In the old days they had had no ladders and rams. They came not by thousands, but in ragged tribes, cowardly barbarians running south before the cold, not staying to live and die on their own range as true men did. There came one with a wide white face and a red plume in his horn of pitch-smeared hair, running to open the gate from within. Wold took a step forward and said, "Stop there!" The Gaul looked around, and the old man drove his 6-foot iron-headed spear into his enemy's side under the ribs, clear in. He was still trying to pull it back out of the shivering body when behind him the gate of the city began to split. That was a hideous sight, the wood splitting like rotten leather, the snout of a thick log poking through. Wold left his spear in the Gaul's belly and ran down the alley, heavily stumbling, towards the house of his kin. The peaked wooden roofs of the city were all on fire ahead of him.